Hello, and welcome to Movies We Dig, the podcast about film, antiquity, and everything in between. I'm Elijah Fleming.
I'm Colin McCormick.
And I'm Christy Vogler.
And today we're talking about season two of Domina, a 2021 British-Italian historical drama television series created by Simon Burke, focusing on the life of Livia, the First Lady of Rome. Season two, you guys, was rough.
Yeah. Okay,
but... You didn't even give me the chance to say I don't dig it.
All right. Wait. Cut that part out, and I'll come back to it.
Yeah. Well, before we get to it, though, like, something else quite lovely came out that I think it surprised us all because the trend had gone away. But if you... I don't know. If you guys are nerds like us, you've probably heard this already.
What are you thinking about, baby?
Me? I'm just thinking about... The Roman
Empire, ancient Rome. Chrissy really just wanted to show off her new soundboard that she got set up.
I was very proud.
What I am digging is the SNL Rome music video.
Yeah. I dug it so much because, like, first of all, Jason Momoa, who, like, that man can do no wrong. And anytime he's somehow adjacent to either Sicily playing Aquaman or just dressing up as a Roman legionnaire.
Literally, like, forgotten about that. It had left my brain.
This is the only part I remember about that film and love so
is
much.
Is there a part where you have to, like, look through Caesar's bust to find Atlantis or something like that?
Something crazy like that, yes.
I just, why? He spoke like a little bit of Italian to a little old lady in Sicily as he's blowing shit up. And I'm just, it was great. That moment. Nothing else. But that moment.
That moment, exactly.
Yeah. And I will say, it's like, what I really loved about the music video is, you know, we had talked about at the beginning of the season that, you know, the whole thinking about Rome trend is this idea that, like, guys are thinking about it, but they're thinking about a very Western civ kind of vision of it, and it's really problematic. And SNL tried to upend that by being like, no, we're gonna shoot straight facts at you about Rome and, like, you know, talk about Hadrian being gay. They sat each other next to each other at the toilets. The statues were actually colorful. And I'm like, oh, you guys have been listening to us. Thank you.
So all that, like, I was pleasantly surprised with it wasn't just like armies and gladiators, and they have the thing like gladiators actually probably didn't really die. You know, it's like, mm-hmm. It's not what you think, but also it does kind of speak to this, like, particularly male fixation with, like, facts and history and knowing things. And, like, it's like almost like Rome, it's almost like Rome-splaining or something like that, where it's like, that's what we're doing, right? Did you know? And, like, babe, did you know, like, Romans are actually also super into astrology?
Yeah.
But I did really appreciate the twist when they pivot to the sun and they're like, well, yes. He's like, nah, I'm thinking about dinosaurs, which is 100% 10-year-old Colin. So I feel attacked, but.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, it's like those things that people and or maybe just children get really, really obsessed and into. That, I don't know, I feel like, yeah, dinosaurs are one of those things that we commonly see.
Trains, planes,
automobiles.
Mm-hmm.
And horses. Then, yeah, like, ancient history, I feel like, is another one of those things that we commonly see people, especially young kids. And I think it's, like, probably people think it's mostly little boys, right? Really into ancient history because of the battles and stuff. But yeah, I think we could always expand that, like, I think there's girls interested in dinosaurs. Like, I think this goes a lot of different ways. And so, yeah, I think I like that it kind of thought about, I'm really, really interested in this thing as just, like, something cool. Oh, you're interested in something cool. Awesome. Great. Dinosaurs, ancient history, whatever. Cool. Be interested in it. Learn a lot about it.
Yeah. So this ancient history being kind of a touchstone for so many people is like, hey, if you like it, get into it any way you can. I think that's been a really interesting thing to think about. And I think why next year Greek mythology is looking huge again. Like, there's so much content Greek mythology related, and not just film, but, like, video games and things like that. And I'm wondering if it's related to this kind of how streaming has really messed up our cultural touchstones. Like, we all have such niche things that we get interested in. There's not, like, the huge experience of Avengers Endgame. Everyone goes to the theater. Or, like, do you guys remember when Harry Potter movies were coming out and you literally could go the night before?
And people lined up outside of Borders, right?
Yeah.
At midnight.
Yeah. Yeah. And we've lost that. Like,
yeah. I mean, it's, I was, my brother and I were talking about this because we, years ago, when the one of the newer Star Wars movies was coming out, and we brought my nephew, who at the time was probably like 7 or 8, and we watched it. And then afterward, we were driving home and we were like, well, like, what'd you think about, you know? He's like, yeah, it was all right. It was like fine. Like, you know, he had some thoughts, whatever. But we couldn't help but notice of just like the way he reacted to, you know, he liked Star Wars. Like, he's like a Star Wars kid, but like he didn't react to it the way like my brother and I like remember when the prequels came out, remember like when like Phantom Menace was coming out and how big and built up. And part of the sort of the thought we had was like, well, like we had been waiting our entire lives for a new Star Wars movie. There was, there had been like Star Wars stuff in the intermediate, but it was like books and some video games and like, you know, lower order, lower tier things. Like, we had not gotten like a Star Wars movie. And now, because there's so much out there, there's so much content being created, and it's also all instantly accessible via the internet and streaming and all that stuff, that is just like that kind of anticipation for one, there's just more things, so there's less stuff for everybody to be into. Like, it's less likely that everybody's going to be into the same thing. And also just like, you don't wait for any of it, right? It's like, it's all very instant.
I wonder if that's why, you know, Hannibal movie, a new Gladiator movie, like why those are becoming so popular is because it's going to a longer history or tradition that we have of understanding Roman and Greek culture. So even if you didn't see the original Gladiator, you have probably still know something about gladiators, and you might be hyped for the movie because of that, not because of seeing the first
movie. I'm hyped for this baboon fight that Ridley Scott keeps teasing.
I made so much fun of that on social media.
I mean, that just struck me as like, it was just kind of on his brain. The interviewer, like, what do you think about it? I'm just like, I saw this video where a person got attacked by baboons and I just couldn't get it out of my head, which is in a way so peak Ridley Scott, because the entire genesis of the movie Gladiator was in, during the pitch meeting, they brought in a copy of that painting, the turned thumb, and he just couldn't stop staring at the painting. And that was what, you know, led him to do the movie. And just like, it's so, I mean, part of it is like, I almost wonder if we could prime Ridley Scott by, we like set up a series of events of things to happen in front of him that he could like fix his fascination on.
Yes, and please. Thus we can like inception on the guy.
Exactly. We can like incept a movie into him by just showing him a series of fascinating images.
And the sad and funny thing about it is like, it's not even the first time a baboon fight or something like that has happened, because you have Disney's Tarzan, of which there was a giant baboon chase.
Yes.
And the bad Indiana Jones. I don't know. They weren't technically baboons, but like,
which one monkeys, are you referring to as the bad?
Crystal Skull. I know exactly what she's referring to. When Shia LaBeouf catches up to, there's a motorcade of like a, that's like basically a snow plow going through the jungle, and he catches up to it by swinging on vines with the monkeys.
Ridley Scott, it's been done. Don't do it.
I don't know. I don't think America's ready for a baboon massacre, but. So Domina?
So Domina.
Domina season 2.
Did you dig season 2 of Domina?
I feel validated in not digging season 1. And I know that's petty of me, but.
That's so petty.
It is. Yeah. No, we're judging you a little bit, Colin, for not loving season 1, but.
I'll be the villain that Rome needs if it's what means restoring the Republic.
Oh my God. Okay, yeah. So I feel like season 1, I thought had like a lot of promise and I enjoyed so many aspects of it, but they like around with this idea of what if there were secret Republicans and Livia was one of them. And I feel like season 2 is, we are like doing the finding out. We have around and now we are finding out, and it doesn't work. Like, we can't explain her being a secret Republican and still try to hit all of these historical like marks that we're trying to hit.
Yeah. You know, for me, season 2 is like, what I loved about season 1 is that you really kind of understood Livia and like some of the historical facts we have of like who divorces their husband while pregnant to marry a guy who divorces his wife while pregnant or just after giving birth.
His daughter's born.
Yeah. 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 It's like, how do you provide context for that that is still relatable and understandable for a modern audience? And I thought they did a lot of that really well. What I think is hard is like, once Domina has established herself as like the matron of this family. And what threat is there to, like, if he didn't divorce her when she couldn't have children anymore, what is there at that point?
Yeah. It's like, where's the story? That point.
Yeah. So I think because Livia, they're still trying to keep the focus on Livia, but Livia's just kind of like, but she's established at this point. So what do you do? And what I will say, what I really liked then is how they looked at the next generation. And especially what I liked about this more than I, Claudius, was kind of giving Tiberius an understandable background for the later atrocities that are attributed to him historically. Like, I can totally see how Tiberius went so wrong, as opposed to I, Claudius, are like, where did this come from all of a sudden? This very extreme behavior. And it's like, yeah, the kid was a fugitive with his parents when he was very little. And that was probably really traumatic. And then your family's dying around you.
I have a question, which about the sort of logic of the show, which was, was the show, because the show kind of dwells a little bit on Tiberius discovering that while he was a baby and in hiding with Livia and her first husband, older Tiberius, that Livia effectively suffocated him to keep him from crying, to hide them from bandits. And then that in the process of that, he died. I think the show implied that like some kind of evil spirit came back with him from the underworld, which explains his alter ego, Bad Tiberius, which felt like a show note that got left in.
Yeah.
Like, well, okay. We'll figure out a name for this later. But
yeah,
I hated Bad Tiberius. I thought it was so stupid. And yeah, I feel like they bring up this and it was like halfway through the season, right? Where they're like, yeah, what if something came back with you? Like, it makes no sense. And I hate
that later
it's like, yeah, Tiberius is haunted or possessed, or I think Antonia at some point is like, oh, it's you, like, can tell somehow that it's not Tiberius, it's Bad Tiberius, and if you see Tiberius, give him my best or something. I'm like, this is so dumb. Like, no. What I liked so much about Tiberius in season one, I think, Christy, is what you were saying, we kind of get an understanding of this like child who grew up in a really, really difficult time and was probably like traumatized and scared for so much of his childhood. And then his mother is gone. He's like, you know, living with his dad. And like, so there's so much stuff that happened that, yeah, this any kid would probably have some trauma attached to them. But like going all in on like weird, possessed, tries to kill Livia, like ends up raping Julia, like Bad Tiberius, I feel like it's just falling into like the same stereotypes that we've always had and goes away from like a realistic portrayal of like, how would this, you know, contextually look for someone who grew up like this? And I was really disappointed with Bad Tiberius.
I could say that, like, you know, it seems like they're trying to imply he has dissociative identity disorder, basically. Mm. And an explanation of some kind of spirit possession being that, that doesn't necessarily pose too much of a problem because mental illness has always been acknowledged in ancient medical history and stuff, but like an explanation for it is very recent. And, sure, you know, yeah, if you think about epilepsy and the Hippocratic Corpus is known as the sacred disease, and based on your symptoms of it, that will dictate who is actually possessing you,
right?
As one of the gods. So it feels like something that could have worked, but I feel they would have had to have some kind of professional who really understands that dissociative identity disorder to bring it in.
Sure.
You know, because it's been popular because you had Moon Knight, super popular with that depiction. Split. You had Split.
It's not quite.
And Split is poorly done in terms of actually representing that disorder. It was just a chance for whatever his name, James
McAvoy.
Yeah, to show off his acting chops. He did a lot of different characters in a single movie. So I think it could have worked had it been more informed. Like, I see where they're going from, but I also have a lot of background knowledge in ancient medicine at this point. So that's why maybe it could click for me, but it's not going to click for most people.
Yeah. And I think I was just, you still really wanted to root for Tiberius in so many ways, because I feel like he and Drusus were like, their scenes together were some of my favorite. I feel like them just like talking to each other or like with their wives, that was like the actual emotional core of this season in a way I didn't really expect.
Antonina, Vipsania, like so many good.
My MVP is Vipsania, who
spectacular.
Has kind of a Luna Lovegood vibe in the show. She's a little like not all there, maybe she's a little airy, for lack of a better word, but just, you know, says very insightful things and basically acknowledges is like, I do not like my mother-in-law. I think one of her first lines in the series that I wrote down was like, I like sex and I don't like my mother-in-law.
Yeah. Yeah, when asked, was like, how do you like married life? Love the sex. Don't love my mother.
Don't love my mother-in-law. It's like, yeah, I love Vipsania. She was so good. I think she and Agrippa are like two of my favorites this season because it feels like he was having fun. he's just storming around, hamming it up.
We talked about this last time, but I can't help but notice the kind of analogs between this show and Rome, where young Tiberius very much feels akin to young Octavian in Rome. Yes. Agrippa in this feels very much akin to Mark Antony in Rome. Scribonia is akin to Servilia in Rome. Mm-hmm. And then Livia is kind of like Adia, loosely. Yeah. That's the loosest one.
Yeah. I mean, basically, if you actually took Livia out of season two, it probably would have been a lot better, which is sad because like the whole series is about her.
Yeah. Well, this is sort of my thesis, is where like the intent of the show comes up against the parameters of the show, I'll say, where it intends like we're going to do air quotes, feminist rewrite of Livia, and we're going to make her, she was maligned and she was secretly good and was doing things, and then was like, so how do we do that? Okay, she was actually a Republican. And then the hook in for that is the historical fact, or the notion from history, that her dad was a sort of dyed in the wool Republican, died at Pharsalus, right? Died sort of with the Republic. Mm-hmm. And then so that she would be carrying a torch for her dad. But then you run up against this problem of Livia, if she's going to be restoring the Republic, the end result that is kind of unavoidable is her immediate descendants all become the next emperors. And so what do you do there, right? And then you end up with this like fifth dimension chess thing, where the scene for me that really kind of broke me was towards the end in one of the last episodes or two, where Augustus floats this thing in front of Livia. It was like, what if I just retired and gave it back to the Republic? And then she says, and then she's like, don't you ever effing say, you know, don't you ever say that to me, like, we worked this hard, like, no way. And then I'm like, okay, so has she given up on the dream? And then later it's like, that was a bluff, to like, he's like calling my bluff, he's trying to like test the waters. And I'm like, this is so overly convoluted that it really like it's all of a house of cards.
That's really interesting, Colin, that like you didn't understand that to be what she was doing at the time it happened, because it's like, I could tell right away, like, she knew he was testing her and she had to pass the test. So I'm wondering if there's
admittedly, I might have just been half watching it, where I'm like, what is it?
That's fair. Yeah. But I wonder if that's why this show is appealing so much to me and Elijah so much, is because like, in terms of survival mode for women around powerful men, like there is kind of a understanding there that maybe that's why those subtle nods is like something that does appeal to me and why I like Livia still.
Yeah.
And I'd be really curious, like, if we pulled a bunch of men and women who saw the show, like, how much do they read into that or not? Because
That's interesting. I do think this was, we f***ed around in season one. Now we're finding out in season two.
I will also say the theme felt like, so you think I were going to poison some people, but no, this season it's strangulation. drowning.
You know, she doesn't poison anybody, but like, okay, this season took like such a short amount of time, I feel like, and I kept waiting for I'm like, all of the people that eventually like become problems are now children, right? Like Germanicus, I think, is here, and we have Lavilla, and there's little like Julia's kids, Gaius and Lucius are here. And I'm like, but they're all kids, and we know that they don't die as children, except for Tiberius. We knew that he died as a child. So it's like, when are we time jumping? Like, what is happening in this space in between?
Well, I wonder, because each season seems to be kind of ending with a prominent death, where in season one, we ended with the death of Marcellus, and who is generally kind of regarded as potentially Livia's first victim, or at least that's maybe where the suspicions usually start swirling that character. And season two ends with the death of Drusus, which in I Claudius attributes to Livia, but actually not really. I think there's a point in I Claudius where mm-hmm. she says, like, I didn't actually kill him that time, yeah. but he was yeah. on yeah. the list. So he had to go. And so Drusus is another one of these, like, you know, if the less generous interpretations would attribute Drusus's death to Livia, though that's a little loose. But then we're coming up. Part of me is thinking is like a structure thing, is just like we end with a big death. Part yeah. of me also, the less generous part of me, suspects that we're kind of holding off on the next couple of deaths, which are Gaius and Lucius, which are notoriously, they are, Gaius at least is a child when he dies.
Right.
Yeah.
And Lucius is not much older. He's like in his late teens or something. I think he's like 18 when he's supposed to die. Yeah, I think
they're both like teenagers, right? They're like 12.
Yeah. That feels likely what would be next, though, Agrippa's sons, because Agrippa's dead. So.
Well, I think they even say that in the last episode when Piso should have died. He had a f***ing sword in his chest.
I know.
Something would have happened if he actually died. I feel like he had no purpose this season anymore anyway. But they have the conversation in the hallway, like at the very end, where I guess Livia just decides, I'm going to kill everybody else so Tiberius can be the next emperor. And like, really? Why? Really?
Then also the internal logic of the show starts to kind of fall apart, because like yes. at first it was yeah. like, okay, we're going to pave the way for Drusus and Tiberius to be co-emperors or something together, right? Where it's like neither of them can really do it by themselves, but together they could effectively restore the Republic. Even sort of putting aside, which I find a bit of a stretch of like that we need these two guys to restore. Like that's the only way to restore the Republic is to appoint them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is to appoint them emperors. She still sticks to the plan, even though Tiberius himself is like, I have no interest in restoring the Republic. Uh-huh. Nor do I really have any interest in like governing at all.
He likes bureaucracy. He likes paper pushing, but like he doesn't need to be emperor to do that.
No.
No. I wonder, because we had talked about with season one, it seemed like Domino was being really careful not to tread similar ground that Rome had. But I think it's also in conversation with I Claudius, because like that's just it, as Colin has pointed out, they have completely changed Livia's motivations from I Claudius to this one. And I think the question that they had is like, okay, her father was a supporter of the Republic, died fighting with Brutus. And then her son Drusus is alleged to have also been a supporter of the Republic. So they are just making the assumption that she was the bridge between what her father believed and what at least Drusus is alleged to have believed. And I think they did that because they wanted to make her different from Livia of I Claudius. And I think they were really successful in season one of avoiding, you know, retrotting where Rome had been. But season two, with that change in motivation, as Colin has pointed out, like it's just not making sense. Unless like the only thing that makes sense is the push in the idea of like in trying to have this goal, she's being corrupted by power. Yeah. She needs power in order to accomplish the goal and is being corrupted by it.
You just gave me a thought, which is, I mean, even just to the things that you that most sort of spoke to you and you liked most about the show is its attentiveness or intuitiveness when it comes to a woman's experience in the ancient world. And to that, I said, like, that's the premise of the show right there, where she doesn't need to have loftier political motivations, I think, to be effective, where it doesn't need to be about restoring the Republic or fixing Rome or saving the people or whatever it is, where if the motivation for Livia was just like, I need to secure security for myself. I need to make a safe place for me and my children.
Yeah.
Power equals security in this context. So if I'm going to be safe and my children are going to be safe, I need power.
Yeah.
And then that means
absolutely
getting your hands dirty. And like, and that, I feel like that should be your end right there.
Yeah.
Where then 100%. You can have both of these worlds, right? You can have Livia be cutthroat, right? We don't need to sort of sanitize it or create the buffer character of Antiope.
Antigone.
You're the buffer character. Like, she can do these bad things, but the motivation is a completely understandable one, because it's about like, if I don't, I look around me and I see these other women who just get used and abused by the men, the system, what have you. And so that's it, right? I want the security, and that means I need the power.
Yes. And they had that in season one, right?
Like 100%.
She didn't want Marcellus to rule, but like she already had the built-in reason of Marcellus was planning to kill her and her sons. Like,
yeah.
And that was the thing. Like Octavia and Scribonia understood why she killed Marcellus first, because, hey, look, Marcellus was planning to do it to her and her children. Like, yeah, you don't need that. You don't need any more than that.
I did like that everybody kind of acknowledges, like, yeah, we never really liked, nobody liked Marcellus. He sucked, and nobody's really all that upset that he's dead. Except for Marcella, who is...
Yeah. Do we know anything about really about Marcella? Because it's like, I kind of felt bad for her at the end there.
I did not feel bad for her. She was so annoying this whole season, and I was like, thank God that, like, a thing happened.
Yeah.
I was so happy that Julia and Euless got to drown her. Like, what?
It was like a Mean Girls moment.
It was. But, like, we do know a little bit about Marcella, because I looked it up. And she actually does have maybe even, like, two children that was not depicted. But, like, you know, she's just kind of there in the background. Like, you know, she doesn't have any huge scandals, so nobody really talks about her.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Julia was really sucking all the air up in that comment.
Yeah, that's very true.
Yeah, and I think that's why her character makes sense, and I think it's why it's okay to like not like her. Like, she's very much meant to be like a character you don't like. But like, if you think about it, it's like she was forced to divorce Agrippa so that Julia could have her. She is mostly playing by the family rules, and no one likes her for it.
Yeah,
and. Mm-hmm. She was kind of the first one to piece together that Livia had the motivation to kill her brother Marcellus. And everyone's like, shut up, Marcel. And it's like, dude, I feel kind of bad for her because, like, yeah, she seems annoying, but like, I understand that she's just frustrated because she's doing everything you're supposed to for this family and getting jack shit out of it. Like, I get it. So,
yep.
So just like, listen, I finally got knocked up by a guy I actually like. I just need Euless, who has been doing his own stupid thing the whole time, to just pretend.
Stupid Euless. Like, come on.
He can't do it.
I thought we were working our way up to Dominicus's death, but.
Domitius?
Domitius, sorry. Yeah. I think my when I was taking my notes, my phone kept autocorrecting his name to Dominic.
Wait, who's Domitius? Oh, he's the guy that Marcella was hooking up with, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And is married to
Antonia.
Married to Antonia, who is lovely. I do like her.
Antonia was nice. Yeah. She was fine.
Well, she was fun when she was working with her sister.
To like run around the house to try to find people at the wedding.
And deal with Julia having a
and Tiberius, break. Like at their own wedding. That was
I loved that. Okay. Actually. I loved that episode. That was so fun.
Well, it was so sad too, because like they find Tiberius and he's just like hanging out with Vipsania and
his Castor,
right?
Yeah.
And they just like, we just wanted to be together. And it's like, you guys. Yeah. No, that was a great scene. The wedding scene was actually really great.
Yeah. I enjoyed that episode quite a bit. And okay, I enjoyed the wedding part of that episode quite a bit because, again, this season two went off the flipping rails with Livia being chased down. But
God, I forgot about that.
That's how Piso got stabbed and then somehow survived. I'm like, no, Piso be dead now. He be dead.
He's dead. He was a sword all the way in the sense.
Like, listen, we knew this season was off the rails when episode one opened with Augustus and Livia getting into a bar fight.
Yeah, that was so weird. Can we talk about Augustus?
Yeah, let's talk about Augustus.
Yeah.
I wish he had been more present and like actually done more things this season.
Like as a father?
Yes, he's a very absent father figure. But no, like I feel like they're setting him up as the big bad. Like he's now the antagonist, right? He has officially like crossed into the whole we don't trust each other. He kills Drusus-ish a little bit.
Right.
Or at least is implicated. Like we're setting him up as the big bad. And I feel like he didn't do enough. Like he just kind of stood around and looked angry this whole season. And I wanted a little bit more, like I wanted to be scared of him a little bit more. Like he and Drusus were supposed to have this big competitive back and forth. And I feel like we saw that twice maybe because they both wanted to sleep with the same German slave who then tried to kill Livia. Y'all remember line. Gemina?
Yep. I'm reminded
I did remember it. And then I decided to forget it again, I think.
Good plan, yes. But then they have like one dice game, right? Like he and Drusus play dice. And it's like I needed a whole lot more for this to be like this tense, as everybody like kept saying that it's so tense. And I don't know.
Yeah. I will say what I did like about the whole Jemima whatever thing is that like when Livia has a premonition that Drusus has died in the battlefield, is that like he walks up to the little girl.
Yeah.
And then it turns into her and he dead. And I'm like, I kind of liked that.
I didn't like anything about Jemima. That was so stupid.
She was a pretty blonde.
That's why she was there.
She was very pretty. Well, and I think it was to point out that in reality, like he was a player. Augustus was a player before he was with Olivia. But that's the thing. It's like Roman men still slept around because that you could.
Suetonius is pretty explicit about how many people's wives Augustus seduced.
Yeah. So they couldn't.
It was more than a few.
And that was the thing, is like this idea of not being faithful to Olivia because he feels like he can't trust her anymore. That just wasn't the equation, right?
No.
There was also a plot line of like Livia's anxiety about aging, and it's like, oh, he's not attracted to me anymore because I'm older now.
Yeah.
Well, because I feel like it's part of like how she has power, right? Is that if you are attractive, then you can be in those situations and sort of be.
And it's so strange because it's like, even though women's sexuality is so controlled. And I mean, one of the whole things about this season is the marriage laws that Augustus passed, which that was interesting. We'll come back to that. But
yeah, put a pin in there.
Like women's sexuality is so meant to be controlled. But at the same time, it's like women have always used their sexuality for some modicum of control as well.
Yeah.
So I think the anxiety is like, I don't think Livia would care if Augustus was sleeping around because that's common. But like if he's not coming to her at all because of these outside relationships, then that might be a reason for concern for her.
Mm-hmm. And then we run up against the kind of, we know that Augustus and Livia stay married to one another until his death. He's like in his 70s, I think, when he dies.
It's so a while.
Yeah.
So question.
Do we get do we think with Augustus being set up as bad, something's going to happen to the figs?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
I think that's really where I thought this was going.
That was where I took it. But that's part of it is also this show has a little bit of the kind of the opposite problem of iClaudius, where we talked about with iClaudius, where it's like, you know, you can never tell how old anyone's supposed to be because you have 40-year-old actors playing 20-year-olds and then 40-year-olds and then 70-year-olds and can't make up. And then this, I also, one of the things I wrote is like, I feel like Augustus and Livia are too old because they're supposed to be in their like late 20s at this point, but they are definitely being played by actors. Their 40s at the very beginning of season one, and then later it made more sense because by the end I think they're supposed to be like at least about age appropriate to the actual actors are in their mid 40s ish or something like that. But then part of me was wondering, I'm like, well, you know, if we're setting up that, like, you know, Livia's gonna poison Augustus, we're like 20 to 30 years off from that,
right? Yeah. So are we doing another age up? Like, are we changing actors?
Well, I mean, I don't know if this not to like spell doom and gloom. I don't know if this show is going to get a season two. We'll see.
Season three? Because it already has a season two.
Yeah. Because I was wondering if there was a budget decrease in this season. But in terms of people that didn't come back, there is a big, giant, conspicuous absence in season two of Antigone.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Which we knew was coming. We didn't know why or like how they were going to explain it, but...
Well, I think the explanation that is Tycho says she, well, actually, I don't know. She died.
I think she died in childbirth.
Or like after childbirth, not long after her daughter was born.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're grooming the daughter to be her replacement, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, because Tycho becomes, you know, Tycho is really ride or die. He becomes Livia's close confidant and henchman. I wondered if it was a situation with.
With the actress.
Yeah. I wonder if it was a situation with the actress, because I know she was on a different show kind of at the same time as she left the show to go do something else, or if there was a contract dispute or whatever. But like for whatever reason, that actress just didn't or couldn't come back. So they had to kind of write around it, which also I think put the show kind of on its back foot because Antigone was so pivotal and so kind of instrumental in the first season that it had to make up for that.
I think yes, and like I think it kind of works out because we had talked about this, right? It's like the impression and the problem with Antigone's character, even though I loved her in season one, was like a lot of bad actions attributed to Livia are all of a sudden being pushed upon Antigone. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I suspected they were going to push for a transition of like, you know, Livia going from unknowing benefactor of a poisoning event to being the one actively, like, she's not necessarily poisoning, like getting people to poison for her, but like her having no qualms about it. Right. Because it's like you have the, like, her no knowledge of poisoning of her ex-husband, and then you have, oh, you did that? Well, okay, I'm going to try with Marcellus, and then we're going to really F that one up. And then we get, you know, the Livia that I love talking to another poison woman and be like, oh, what do you like to use?
Yeah.
While they're eating.
Exactly.
Yeah. Oh, my God. That was so good.
So, like, it could have worked, but you definitely tell they felt a little lost because it's like all of a sudden there's a daughter, and the daughter is training up to eventually be what Antigone was to her.
Sure. Which, yeah, I feel like is we're still trying to put some sort of blame somewhere else, anywhere else.
Yeah.
And it doesn't, I think, Colin, you said this, I don't mind Livia being like ruthless and cutthroat. I think it makes sense. And I almost like want more of that. Like, you know, she had maybe her hesitancy moment in the beginning in season one, but certainly by the end of season two, she's like 100% all the way in. Yeah. You know, sent Marcella to be killed by Ulysses and Julia with like no qualms. So,
yeah,
I don't mind her having the responsibility or being the one like actually doing the actions. And I'm almost glad, that Antigone wasn't there, even if we could kind of feel her absence narrative wise.
Colin, if you don't mind, I do have one sound clip that kind of it comes from the last that I'll play and we can reflect on, but if we're quiet and you need to edit it out, you totally can. But
if you take your revenge, you'll lose your power. If you keep your power, you'll spend the rest of your life with the man who killed your son. But he didn't die entirely in vain. No. At least I'm free, released from your hopeless quest to restore the Republic. That dream died with my brother.
You should have killed me when you had the chance.
I completely forgot about the Tiberius tried to murder Livia part.
Right?
Until now, I was just reminded, I'm like, oh, right. And then Tycho passed it off as like, no, it was just a bad dream.
Yeah. So basically that is also towards the end. And of course, Antonina's standing there too. She's like, yeah, which is it? And her answer is like, both. I'm going to get both.
Also, this is a real, just minor note. Somebody should really do an internal investigation because these houses are so conducive to spying because every single wall is like a lattice work grate that people can just stand behind. Like no conversations are private. You can all you got to do is just stand behind the next room and you can just listen in onto the most private conversations about matters.
I'm sure that's intentional like though, right?
Little curtains. I'm like, what is that curtain doing? It's like see-through. Like stop it. No.
It's like we designed our houses to be like just all these little spy holes.
It'd be really cool if someone knew like how like Roman houses really well to be like, is that how it was set up actually? So that women or advisors or whatever could be like secretly listening into conversations and they can give insight.
One of the things I noticed and feel like could have done more with is a lot of people in this show are having basically straight up seditious conversations just in front of like guards and servants and slaves and things like that, which at a certain level, there's a bit in the I don't think we mentioned this when we were talking about the show, but in I, Claudius, the actors were kind of instructed to that when it came to like when there were extras and stuff, we were playing enslaved people that like don't even acknowledge them. Think of them as like furniture or like, you know, in the same way, like you wouldn't like thank your washing machine. You wouldn't like, you know, maybe something like something could have been done where that evil were like these people don't even register that they're literally talking about murdering one another and marching armies into Rome. And there's just like a fan waver or like somebody with a bowl of grapes, like right there. Which I mean, don't know if it's at a certain level of like, right, like not like they wouldn't even acknowledge the presence of an enslaved person. But also that seems to be surely like
in practice, like,
yeah,
improbable. Like, and like even in that, season like, one, we had like a lot of slaves who were employed in the like Whisper network. Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Livia's whole spy network is essentially a series of
slaves.
Yeah. Yeah. But isn't that kind of the assumption that we make, is that either you assume that your slaves are so loyal to you that, you know, they wouldn't go spilling your secrets, or alternatively, for not being loyal, you could be cruel. And like, because we hear these threats all the time of like, oh, just torture the slave to like get the information and stuff like that. So it's either like the idea of like sincere loyalty or instilling so much fear in a slave that the threat of giving away secrets is not worth it for them.
The fact that often gets rolled out is that like a slave's testimony in Roman law was only admissible if administered under torture. And then there's all sorts of questions that radiate out of that, is like, how often was that actually put in practice? Or what if there are situations where someone was like, yeah, I'm totally ready to confess. Like, do we just kind of like go through the motions of torture? Like, I'm going to pinch you and like, we'll call it torture. And like, okay, like here's your confession.
That's how, you know, the laws were made by people who owned property, right? Because like that law was specifically meant to help masters control their slaves and the secrets they held around their slaves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I lost my train of thought. But on the same point of like, this house is so conducive to spying. Also, everybody is making it so easy to spy on them by just talking very openly.
That's why they go to the mausoleum. Nobody goes and over listens to the mausoleum conversations, supposedly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay,
so I get, we lost the train, but back to the Tiberius almost killing Livia and shoot Tiberius,
and then killing his bastard, well, not his child, but the bastard child of Julia.
Yeah.
Because.
Well, I don't know. Because we know that baby dies.
Yes. Well, that's one thing. baby dies, but also
his attempt to kill his mother makes perfect sense to me. Like in this show. Not in the reality of it.
But then we run up into a situation where, okay, but we know he still ends up on the throne.
Yeah.
And because there's still like four more people have to die before that's even an option for him.
Yeah. Yeah.
I do think that when he kills little Tiberius.
Tiberius.
Tiberius, I think.
Yeah.
He says like, at least you'll never have to run for. Yeah. At least you'll never have to run for consul. So I feel like he's like, better that you are dead and you don't grow up in this family, and or Livia will try to kill you when you're older anyway. So I feel like he was trying to do, in a super twisted way, like,
that's a good point.
A good thing.
He could be worried about his mother doing it. But I think the reason he also does it, because, you know, he's not doing it to his own legitimate child with Vipsania, for example. Vipsania.
But Castor isn't really like...
We're hearing the whisperings that Augustus wants to adopt, right? Because this is an actual child between the two of our families.
Right.
Yeah.
Even though that's not true. It's amazing how oblivious Augustus is sometimes. But I think that's his fear, is like, if this child lives, that will just actually give Augustus a reason to put Tiberius in line for taking over for him. Because, if the kid is only three when Augustus kicks the bucket.
Yeah, then that makes sense. Yeah.
My sort of read on the scene is that whenever bad Tiberius comes out, he just kind of has to kill someone, which we saw a little bit of this at the end of season one, where he strangles the sex worker. Yeah. And it sort of seems like he had, like, bad Tiberius has, like, lusts that, you know, that when he comes out, he needs to, like, murder and kill, and he becomes like possessed in a sense.
Yeah. It is interesting to note, it is specifically in both those killings, it is specifically strangling or suffocation, which is supposedly what triggered bad Tiberius in the first place. So he's kind of apparently subconsciously was recreating the moment of when he dissociated, basically.
Right.
Yeah.
Through that process. So that could be what they're trying to do with it. It's just he has to recreate that moment in which the dissociation took place when he goes into that personality.
When you say it out loud like that, I like it a lot more.
I know, same. Yeah, I feel like they didn't show it.
See, you need my ancient medicine background, y'all.
I also kind of wish that his childhood trauma had been a philosopher pushed him off a cliff, which would explain his later obsession in life of pushing philosophers off cliffs.
That would make a lot of sense. Yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Excellent.
All right. We do have one more character, or at least one more character I think we really need to talk about, and it's Julia.
Yeah.
And Agrippa.
We talked a little bit about Agrippa. But
we love Agrippa, and we loved his death. His death was, like, heartwarming.
I was so pissed. I'm like, the cold open is where we kill Agrippa? Really? Like,
well, this is a really, really nice death. But for his children, that seems horrifying.
Horrendous.
Like, we were.
Daddy didn't wake up, mommy.
We were having a lovely afternoon with our father while our mom was giving birth in the wagon. And then our dad just, like, died while holding us.
Okay. Yeah. Good point.
Terrifying. I wanted so much more for Agrippa. I always loved when he was on screen. I feel like he was just
Ben
a
Bat kind of. Well, how do you feel about the Agrippa Livia ship that the show kind of goes with?
Stupid.
Yeah, okay.
Wait, what?
Stupid.
Oh, that. Yeah.
Yeah, that he's always been carrying a torch for her, and then.
Yeah.
It made some sense in the way that, like, these characters have kind of worked together and, like, been kind of this force in politics all together. But I feel like we didn't super need it.
That was for like a small subset of watchers of Livia Agrippa shippers. And you're like, you know what, you guys, we'll throw you a bone.
Now you've raised a question of like, obviously for any franchise of any popularity, there's always going to be fan community shipping various characters together. But now I'm like, are there like ancient history shippers? Are there people out there like, totally. Man, I really like, wait, like I'm writing my fanfic about Maecenas and Agrippa.
Isn't that what Achilles and Patroclus is in a lot of ways?
Yeah.
Like, not saying they weren't, but like, there's enough of a question there that you can run with it really far. And is Briseis a threesome? Is it a throuple? Who knows?
My read on the fifth century obsession with Achilles Patroclus is it's them basically rewriting themselves into Homer and being like, this is like our practice. And so it's in Homer, therefore it justifies why we want to have these kinds of relationships.
It's better than our 2000s explanation of like cousin love.
Oh my God. That was maybe, you know, everybody gripes about David Benioff and the end of Game of Thrones season 8, but the first blood really, right? His first crime against fan communities was when he made Patroclus Achilles his cousin back in 2004.
100%.
His younger cousin. Patroclus was older than Achilles. That's what I love that people don't understand.
I mean, here's a very ungenerous reading was maybe we can go even further with it. Like one, that movie had a lot of cousin dynamics because I think Briseis was also like Hector's cousin
of Hector.
Maybe it's the same thing. Maybe it's like a Arrested Development, like cousins dangereux or something like that. in this show, Domina, everybody is everyone's cousin, but actually
and they recycle through each other's names.
I think they did a good job trying to differentiate most of them.
They did.
I mean, when you get Agrippina and Agrippinilla and Agrippinina, like.
And Antonina instead of.
Well, yeah, they did Antonina instead of just Antonia Minor. Right? Yeah. Other one.
Okay. Question. Did people, you know how we have junior here? Just like, did people just actually get called minor and major?
That's possible. Yeah.
I don't know why, but it just like it jumps out of my brain. There's definitely a Cicero letter. I think it's to Cicero, maybe from Atticus or something like that. But he's asking about Cicero's kid, and he refers to Cicero's kid as Tullius or something like that, right? Like little Tullius.
Yeah.
So
little diminutives. Yeah.
Here's my kind of major theory that I'm going to put forward of like my historical interpretation of the real problem with Rome is nobody could get out of their dad's shadow because everybody is freaking named after their father and they're just looming. They're looming over you at all times. And if that wasn't enough, when your dad dies, you get a copy of his face to put on your wall.
Yeah.
And this is my theory that explains all of Roman history and all the decisions that everybody makes is this just everybody's dad just looming over them in their minds.
Is it always just dad too? Or is it like our, you know, great-great-grandpa who founded the Republic and killed king number right. three or whatever.
Yeah. Exactly. Who yeah, you were yeah. also named after.
Yes. Right.
And that, and yeah, your grandfather defeats Hannibal or, you know, right? conquers Britain or
intergenerational trauma originated by the Romans.
And everybody is just reminding of you of it for the rest of your life. And you're like, well, you didn't conquer Africa.
It's just okay. Bringing it back to Julia, what do you guys think of her characterization, especially going into season two and kind of this is her slut phase, era? I guess.
It's yeah. I would say it's her euphoria phase.
Okay. Yeah. Well, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, because yeah, I think she seems like this depiction of her. We really, really understand where her kind of insane decisions maybe come from because she feels like she could never make her own decisions.
Yeah.
And I think she says at some point, she's like, I'm 27. I've had 5 kids and 2 marriages. Leave me alone.
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Like, I get that. Mm-hmm. I think they also fall into the same stereotype of just like, Julia is a slut.
Yeah.
And like, if we're trying to be a little bit more contextual or like have a little bit more of a feminist bent, we might argue, does she need to be going about it that way? I'm not sure. So I think she was drunk or like falling over most of the season, at mm-hmm. least for the second half. And I kind of wanted, just like Tiberius, I wanted like a little bit more like humanness from Julia, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right. Like if they had to keep her just going off the rails, like this season, I think they at least gave her a good context for why she did, because she's yeah. like, I might as well be a slave. Like my body doesn't belong to me, so anyone mm-hmm. can have it who wants it. And I think you can understand that, especially because I think in season one, Augustus almost tries to push his sister to get married again, right? And yeah. she's like, nah, you're not making me. And Julia, because she is Augustus's only legitimate child, doesn't get to say no. And like, that's yeah. really interesting to think about, especially because, yeah, if you're trying to, you know, have a dynasty or whatever, and she's you know, the only legitimate heir coming from Augustus, is like, she's never going to really have an option about her mm-hmm. life, even though she produced children with Agrippa.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But that's not good enough.
Yeah.
I'd be pissed.
No, I think totally. I think at one point, is it Ulysses who asks her? He's like, are you like trying to kill yourself, or are you like doing this mm-hmm. on purpose, or you're dying or something? She's like, yeah, I know. And I don't know why it hasn't happened yet. Or like,
yeah.
she's mm-hmm. like actively in self-destructive mode.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think they do have like good context for why someone would be in that position.
Yeah.
I just could, when you mentioned the slave analogy, I was instantly reminded of the opening of the Titanic, which is the kind of less gracious version of that, where Rose sure. says something to the effect of the Titanic was a slave ship bringing me over to the Americas in chains. And everyone's like, oh my God. Like,
okay.
Yeah. I mean, part of it, I mean, there is the ingredient of her lack of agency and decision making, but also her like her privilege is also, I think, part of it too, or of like, well, mm-hmm. the one that she just has, she can just like get drunk all day and mm-hmm. hang around. Sure. Why she is, it's just like double-edged sword. I don't have a very coherent thought on that matter other than, right, there's this one dimension of her, is that she's kind of just this like destructive, nihilistic rich yeah. girl.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think, yeah, it's probably like her privilege and her ability to do those things that allows her to like make the choices that they kind of set her up to do, mm-hmm. like mm-hmm. all of the drinking and all of the like partying and having sex. Because, yeah, I think you're right. If she wasn't who she was, she would have more agency, but she also like wouldn't have access to like yeah. unlimited wine and just like doing whatever the f- she wants.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I do see that as like framing the choices that she makes. Because she does at some point this say, like, she snaps at a few people of like, and I'm the daughter of Augustus, right? Like
yeah.
she uses it, I think, when she wants to.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's why it pisses Marcella off so much,
oh,
right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Like yep. she gets to be treated like the princess, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But she acts out in ways that no one else gets to.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, that's the secret sauce of
yeah.
whatever version of Julia is, right? Which that sort of trifecta of expectations uh-huh. and wealth and privilege.
Yeah.
All in this perfect storm to create
She just seemed the most believable for like what her historical, what we know of her historically and what happens to her eventually.
Which is, again, also opens the kind of door for, right, if we're, I mean, if we're, we're taking a free pin, but we're playing very fast and loose, there is a very real possibility that Julia's reputation is entirely undeserved or unearned. It may be, I mean,
Yeah. Well, I think that's always my problem when, like, reimaginings or retellings of this particular narrative still go all in on the weird sex stuff for everybody. Yeah. Right. It's like, that's one of the things that you would say about somebody if you were trying to discredit them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, Messalina is kind of the most extreme example because Messalina is like, it's so over the top that it really strains credulity. And you listen to that story and like, this feels like something a very angry eighth grader wrote about their classmate.
And it's something to note that like, because Augustus and Livia are the first, it is their immediate children, Julia and Tiberius, who get this treatment, right?
And this, here's the segue. Here's the flawless segue that you're all going to stand up and applaud, and we can end the show. But the reputation, I think part of the reason people really want to buy into Julia's reputation for wantonness is because of Augustus's fixation on the marriage laws and Roman marriages and traditional monogamous marriages. Thank you. I will accept my Oscar for
brilliant, by the way.
Yeah, you get the Oscar for sound design.
Thanks. Yeah, I've got a lot here. I'll play the other one that I was in love with.
Tragically, I am a woman.
Which is kind of a summation of the season.
But you know, Christy, you said something about the marriage laws that you wanted to come back
to. So it was very interesting that the motivation for it, as shown in this show, is like it was heavily pushed by Livia in anticipation with this issue of Antonina being married to Drusus. Right? Which was... they can't all of a sudden back out of the fact that, like, one of Augustus's nieces is going to be unwed. The only acceptable thing is either she weds Drusus or she becomes a Vestal Virgin. Which was a fun storyline overall. Fun. You guys, I remembered the Vestal Virgin all of a sudden.
Yes,
one who oh my God.
She got, I wrote in my notes, she gets cast of Amontillado. Did they Amontillado her?
I forgot about that until I just said it. I'm like, oh,
completely forgot.
And at that point, this is also where I wrote in my notes. So, like, for those who haven't seen the show, basically, there is a Vestal Virgin who's causing problems for Livia because she reveals that she was the one that helped Livia conspire to reveal. This is all also told in exposition narrative. This is not this would have been a great thing to have in season one, but we never got it. But that Livia basically struck a friendship with this Vestal Virgin to manipulate her into removing Mark Antony's will from the Temple of Vesta, where it should be kept and supposed to be sacrosanct, and nobody's allowed to see it. And Livia did this so Augustus could read the will and reveal to the world that Mark Antony may or may not have been conspiring to cede Rome and everything to Cleopatra and his children with her, which is the final break. It leads to Augustus's war with Mark Antony and Mark Antony getting defeated and Augustus and empires and all that.
Wait. Question real quick. Isn't the children of Cleopatra and Mark Antony adopted by Octavia?
Well, now I'm remembering the history because Mark Antony was married to Octavia and then...
Yes.
This also, and now I'm wondering like how much of this is.
Because I know they survived.
Real? Yeah.
The one was Julius Caesar was killed. Yeah. But the children with the Mark Antony were not killed.
I think the twins might have been I don't know. Oh, crap.
It's so confusing. History is confusing, you guys. Okay, sorry. Continue, Colin.
No, that's good. That Vestal Virgin, Thuria, right? Or Turia, she now comes back and she wants revenge against Livia and is causing problems vis-a-vis Augustus's will, that Livia now wants to be messing with Augustus's will. And then to get rid of this Vestal Virgin, this is a harder than normal murder because nominally, one, she's a religious figure and that's a bad look. And two, Vestal Virgins are sacrosanct. You're not allowed to touch, like people aren't even allowed to touch them or harm them in any way. Their bodies are sacred. Mm-hmm. So it's a big ask. So the workaround is they force Turia's carriage into a cave and waller up inside of it. And I wrote to myself, I'm like, at this point, there's no coming back for Livia, right? After this, like, this was like evil.
Yeah. This was Verenus attacking the figure of, who was it, Harmonia?
Concordia.
Or Concordia, something like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. In Rome. This was that moment.
It was just like, my God, this is right damning. You know, however annoying Turia was, I don't know if she deserved that to happen to her.
I know, right? That's really awful. Okay, yeah. I just looked it up and it appears that, yes, the twins were, at least for a time, in Octavia's household.
That's what I thought.
And they were
we never see them. I thought that's who Ulysses was for a while. And I'm like, nope, that is not who Ulysses is.
Nope.
These people got around.
But like with each other. That's the part that makes it so confusing.
I know. Yes. Yes.
Yeah. And so, yeah, I do think that the whole marriage law thing, which has always been like a big question mark, just historically, that it was kind of funky to see it kind of pushed into this format of like, well, we got to get these two kids married.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially because my experience with those laws and the way that, I've interpreted it outside of Rome, basically, is that like that actually is what presented a lot of women an opportunity to gain more autonomy and independence from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A tutor or from their paterfamilias, because you crank out enough kids, you don't have to answer to anybody, which is really interesting to think about, right? Because like Augustus is surrounded by women who have power and autonomy in a way that they didn't in the Republic as much.
In the show Rome, it kind of sets up that, or at least the germ of that idea is Augustus's like appeal to the women of Rome. He has a whole speech in that one episode in season two, where he's like, women are the foundation of this city, particularly like the kind of underwritten part is women who have children are the foundation of this city. Before we go, you know, ascribing any feminist inclinations, that is.
Yeah.
Because the kind of, I guess the simplest interpretation of the law generally is part of a larger Augustus program to kind of bring Rome back to sort of traditional moral alignment. And then the other sort of more pragmatic reason is we want more Roman citizens. And the way to have more Roman citizens, to increase the population of citizens of Rome, is we need to encourage marriage. We need to give incentives for marriage. One of them being women who have three children now have this special legal privilege where they don't need, like Christy was saying, they don't need like a co-signer for legal documents. They have certain, they can represent themselves in certain like legal affairs. And it's all sort of designed to create more citizens, one, to increase the population, to increase the taxable population.
Yep, the taxable body. Yep.
That's really interesting, too, because it's like at this point, Rome is still expanding. And the biggest issue that probably led to all of the initial fights of the Republic and the eventual collapse of the Republic is the need to reward soldiers. But a lot of these soldiers were not considered citizens. And giving them citizenship is what got a lot, like the Gracchi brothers got in trouble for trying to grant citizenship to individuals and stuff. So this is a way to create citizens, but that already would be acknowledged as like part of the Roman civilization population.
Yeah. And possibly the fear of like the influence of Romans, like Romans in Rome being diluted by, say, like other cities in Italy. Oh my God.
They started white replacement theory.
Yes.
Yes. It kind of, that is sort of the underlying, like, yeah, like, well, what if there's a situation where, like, all of a sudden there's more Roman citizens in, like, France or North Africa or something like that? And, like, what does it mean to be Roman anymore?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, that was definitely that underlying anxiety that's just, like, bubbling under. And
back to HBO's Rome, the hostility that the Roman senators feel when all of a sudden a bunch of Celts are let into the Senate.
Yep.
Which is accurate. Definitely. Like that's how so many political leaders were offed, was moves like that.
Yeah. And then there's always, right, the kind of like, well, there's even like the people that are trying to extend citizenship to previously disenfranchised parties, or it's not purely for altruistic reasons.
Oh, no.
Right. To like Eli said, increase the taxable body, to create political, like, right, if I don't have enough political support now, what I do, you know, I can create more, right, by granting these sort of rights. So, I mean, I don't know.
Well, you're like, creating an entire group of people who you assume will vote for you because you have now included them.
Mm-hmm.
This also opens up also the whole realm. We're getting a far field, but the realm of like formerly enslaved people and freedmen and the children of freedmen. And those kind of like Augustus creates certain priesthoods and like fraternities, for lack of a better word, like these organizations, collegia, that are for freedmen. that are like the Serwiles Augustales, right? That they are. And there's a plot line with the Augustales in this. Am I making
that
up?
Yeah.
No, it's Thermiromai. It's because they go to the Augustales. Shit, you're right.
Yep.
What do we do with this situation, right? What do we do with these emerging classes of citizenship? Now, also that wealth is no longer entirely concentrated in the landed nobility. Now people are creating, you know, we've created this new economic world by making the sea safe. And now people can trade from Spain to France to Italy to Africa to Egypt. And now people can make money. You know, people can come into boatloads of money in various business ventures, and then they want this. These are all very interesting questions. This goes beyond the show.
Yeah, no, it's like all of a sudden we got into the Augustan marriage laws. I'm like, oh, look at us being nerds.
This turned into a Roman history podcast, which is
I know it did.
It does sometimes. Yeah. All right, I have like one. It's not a character, but it's the scene that got to me. It was the
emotional damage
scene. Flash does not know that meme, apparently.
Oh my god.
It really scared me.
I'm sorry.
I was like, what's happening?
Look it up sometime, Flash. It's great.
Yeah, just look up emotional damage and you'll
okay.
She pulls out her phone already. So for me, my favorite scene in the entire season 2 was the death of Drusus. Mm-hmm. Dude, that was heart-wrenching. I was close to crying because it's like Tiberius. Like his brother's blind, and
why was he blind?
He just had a head injury.
Why
I think
was he that blind?
Was
the okay.
Infection
can cause that, right?
Have either of you seen Dunkirk?
Yeah.
Barry Keoghan's character gets hit on the head and then is blind before he dies. But I'm citing that like it's a medical case. But.
Well, I just when he says like he can't see you or like he's blind, I expected like something to have been gouged out because we hadn't seen Drusus yet. And I was like, well, what happened to him?
Sepsis like, can lead to organ damage, including kidneys and liver. In some cases, it can also lead to eye problems, including vision loss.
Okay, all right. I mean, I assumed it was, you know.
Or counter theory, it was a ghost.
It was Gemini's ghost, to be specific.
To be specific, yes.
Her revenge on the man she loved.
I don't know if this is just maybe I'm like too used to things being like really gory and gross, but like I wanted to see what happened to Drusus. I feel like he was always under a blanket or they just showed like his head. And they said something like he had a spear in the leg,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
But like we never see it. We never see him get hit. We never see the battle. And so I was just like, I felt like I didn't fully know what was wrong for a bit.
I think they would have said to the leg because then they made the cover story. He fell off his horse, right?
Yeah.
Not that he'd been done in by sabotage.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No. I also did like his death scene. I thought, but again, I think like the scenes with Tiberius and Drusus mm-hmm. seem to have more of an emotional core to them than a lot of the other scenes.
Yeah.
And yeah, I thought it did remind me of, oh God, what was it? One of the really old movies that we watched where I think it's Seneca and Nero and Seneca.
Oh, is it Quo Vadis when Petronius?
Yes.
Okay.
It was Quo Vadis. And it made me think of that, but like done well, mm-hmm. if that makes sense. I was like, okay, this isn't like goofy and weird. It's like actually sad and painful. And then like Livilla who comes up and it's like, again, like our children are like right here. I'm just dying.
It's Antonina, right?
Well, no, there's the girl.
Oh, the children themselves. Yeah.
I was wondering because I'm like, where's Claudius? This is
he's mentioned once. Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I love how this show is literally just in conversation with Romani Claudius, I swear.
No, I 100% agree. Yeah. I think it's one impossible not to be, even unintentionally.
Yes.
But things like not having Claudius in the picture or even Germanicus. I expected to see a little Germanicus running around.
Yep.
We did see him in that scene as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Germanicus, he was there once or twice, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Also, just side note, we don't have to talk about her too, but I do love Antonina. Like, she was fun. She's like, I'm going to dress up and go on the front lines. And
okay, I thought, maybe it was just me, but I thought it was implied that she was having an affair with that German soldier.
Herman the German?
Not Herman, but yeah, the other German, Sherman.
Sherman the German, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, she wears like trousers, or not trousers, but she wears like a armor kind of thing.
Yeah.
I just loved it.
Well, she has that conversation because, like, when she's about to be married to Drusus and she's talking to Vipsania, and Vipsania is like, Livia's going to interview you, and I don't know, like, what the answers mm-hmm. are. She doesn't like me. And
who knows? I got them all wrong.
But Livia says things like, you are a woman after my own heart. And she becomes like Livia's protege or something, which is also funny because, again, in conversation with like Claudius, where Antonia is the opposite of Livia.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I just want to look through if there's anything that I.
Yeah. Let's look at plot lines again because we keep forgetting about things that happen and then.
Mm-hmm. Well, I do feel like nothing happened, and then I keep remembering like weird things that I didn't like. So,
maybe. Well, one thing I do want to praise about the show is I love the set design.
Yep.
And the costuming, mm-hmm. which I think is a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. Although they are fixated with that bathroom.
They really are.
But also Bikini Girls. I did appreciate that because like that's one of my favorite mosaics from the bath set, Piazza Armorina. And I'm like, oh, they're wearing the bikinis to the beach. I love it.
Yeah.
So I guess, okay. So we need to think of our closing sort of question for the group. What would it be? What's it going to be?
I guess what would you want to see out of a season 3 if that happens, which I kind of doubt.
So I'm going to talk through it as I think.
Yeah.
If we're going with this theme of each season kind of ends with the death of a major character, culminating in probably the show finale, if it ever happened, I feel like the natural culmination would be Tiberius's coronation, for lack of a better. He doesn't really have a coronation, but like whatever the approximate of that would be.
Sure.
So that means, to my knowledge, the next ones down the line, Agrippa's out of the way, Drusus is gone, Marcellus is gone. That means I think it's got to be Gaius and Lucius, which is probably the trickiest one to navigate because, like I said, Gaius is so young when he dies. Although that one could very well have been just natural death.
Yeah.
As would have happened to many, many people in antiquity.
That could be interesting too, is like he could die and that is something that could fall back on Livia. Like maybe Livia didn't have anything to do with it, but there's so much suspicion.
Yeah.
And like, especially because like she obviously very much cared for Agrippa.
Yeah.
And she has mixed feelings about the children, his children being adopted. Because it's like, well, that's going to F up my plans. But I think, you know, that's going to be really hard, is like he could just die of natural causes. Yeah. But like suspicion falls on her. And how does she deal with that?
I think really for most kind of like the ancient sources and like the Robert Graves and later, it's not just that one. It's the 1-2 of Gaius and Lucius dying so close to one another.
Yeah.
That is what kind of raises people's suspicions. And then maybe that leads into he's only a baby right now, but posthumous, where one of the things kind of we didn't really talk about this, I think, with Claudius, but posthumous is a character that Graves and Claudius really resuscitate that character, because in Tacitus and Suetonius, Tacitus mostly, posthumous is not a favorable guy. He's remembered as being like a brute and a bully and kind of a knuckle dragger, kind of like he was remembered for being sort of hostile and unlikable, kind of like the way Marcellus is in this show. So posthumous seems like he's the real one. He's the one that if Livia murdered any of the three of them, he's the one that she probably actually did murder.
Yeah.
That's funny. Yeah.
Not without reason.
Yeah. And so we'll have to get a significant time jump then.
Right.
Because posthumous doesn't die until he's
in his 20s at least.
Yeah. Late 20s.
Well, maybe? I think the other major storyline going on is obviously Julia and Ulysses. And we've got to have the fallout from that.
And that does happen. Like,
So I think that's got to be the next big setup right there. Right.
Yeah.
As well. I could see that be a mid-season death happening, sort of, and then a time jump.
Another kind of situation, I think, where the show, the premise is at odds with the parameters of the show, where the show is so solely fixated on Livia, and we're quickly entering into a period where Livia is going to recede more and more into the background of just events happening. And so where does the show end with her death? Does it end with, even if it ends, like I said, like where I would suspect it would end with Tiberius's ascension, there's a lot of like filler, and Livia would be quite old by the time that happened.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, and it's only called Domina. So you could, have been primed to think this is about Livia, but we could, same as I Claudius, right? Like we can have a major shift in focus. Yeah. Okay, so then that's the question. Who do we vote most likely to be the next Domina?
Antonina. Antonina.
I think Livia all but said it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure. And now I'm wondering about, they've kind of set up Domitius as like
the next villain.
Kind of, well, yeah, villainy, but he's like, she's trying to like
control him
in so many ways.
Wait. I got that soundbite too.
I will keep your secrets and support your ambitions with my husband.
And in return,
I own you.
Yeah. So, like, yeah, Domitius, like, has his own ambitions and, like, causes a famine to make money, which I found so funny, actually. That was, like,
actually,
one of my favorite
storylines. Actually, yeah, that was a good opening plot line.
Yeah, and I kind of wish that it went on a little bit longer. It seemed to, like, wrap up really quickly.
Well, it was one episode, right?
More and then, like, I think afterward
it comes back.
They like talk about it, but he like is the other one who's like scheming, or that we're like seeing that he's doing manipulative things behind the scenes, and
he's the one who doubts Livia's capability, right?
Well, he doesn't believe a woman could be capable of anything. Basically,
this is Rome. Women have no ideas.
Exactly.
There you go. I have all my sound bites. You will get no more for today, I promise.
No, that was great.
Yeah, that was awesome.
I thought he was going to be axed off in this season, but...
I kind of did, too. Yeah.
But I do like that Livia appreciates an actual smart opponent, because that's kind of what it is, right? Like, everyone she offs is, like, people who actually will do her damage.
Marcellus was useless.
Yeah.
Or are just completely useless. It's like, nobody's going to miss you, so...
Yeah, but Domitius is—he's very. That's a deal with the devil, right there, right?
Yes. Yeah,
yes.
He is.
So
not
I could
to be
see
trusted.
That. Yeah, I could see that being another like big bad coming into a next season,
a proto Sejanus, if you will.
Mm. Yeah.
All right. Any other closing thoughts before we wrap it up?
Just watch season one.
Cool.
Or watch season two and ignore Livia. Just focus on the others. Because, like, I don't know. Damn. I liked what was going on with a lot of the other characters. Yeah. If you weren't focused on Livia.
Yeah. She was smarter in season one.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, part of me now wonders if it's part of the television landscape where, like, no one's guaranteed a finale to their show, right? So, like, we set up a, is it almost like the mystery box style? Like, we'll set up intrigue. We don't know how we're going to end the injury. We don't know how we're going to resolve it, but we'll set it up and then we'll just keep it going as long as, you know, it's like a metaphor for power in Rome.
Somehow Disney's already got fourth Frozen film on the docket, but like, we can't figure out if any of our TV shows we actually enjoy are going to make it.
Yeah, I like that. The show is a metaphor for itself, which is
pretty much.
Yeah.
Huzzah!
Sometimes it scares me, Christy. I don't know what's happening.
You should get if it's not on there, you should definitely put it in Are You Entertained?
Oh, damn it. Okay, wait. This one's for you, Colin.
Hold your tongue. I will tell you what I want and you will provide it.
Yeah, that's 9. I like that.
That's so good.
Yeah, give me. I would request like a whole column on the soundboard of just Livia quotes from my Claudius.
I can't believe that worked. I didn't even know what I was saying.
I went all over the place. I've got Zuko. I've got Mabel Pines. I've got the Catherine the Great here. Well, I already played this one, but this one's still good.
If Trident can't keep me dry, then this thing can suck my.
My favorite Titan Pulo moment.
So good.
I don't know where to go from here, so I'm going to start reading the outro.
Okay.
Thank you again for listening. We hope you enjoy the show. If you want to listen to more from us, you can follow us at moviesredig.com. Listen to us on most major streaming services. You can follow us also on Instagram and Blue Sky at @digmovies and support us on Ko-fi. Thank you again, and we will be back. We recorded it out of order, but we're going to finish with a nice little animated treat featuring a return special guest as we talk about bathing culture, both here and abroad. Thank you again. Bye, guys.
Bye.